This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economic Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net. Hello, my name's Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 28th of January 2009, our guest speaker was Professor Jeff Harcourt of Jesus College, Cambridge, speaking on the theme Keynes, Joan Robinson and the General Theory. You can also download a handout to go with the talk from the Keynes Seminar page on the PKSG website. Enjoy listening.
Thanks very much, Mark, and thank you very much, all of you, for coming out on a cold night like this to Fortress Robinson. I do appreciate it. Some of you know I have diabetes. This is a banana in my pocket, but I am pleased to see you. Prue Kerr and I have just literally this week sent the manuscript of our intellectual biography of Joan Robinson to Palgrave Macmillan to be published in Tony Thirlwall's series Great Thinkers in Economics. And what I'm going to talk to you about tonight is chapter 3 of the book, which goes under the rather ponderous title of Joan Robinson and Her Circle in the Run-Up to and Aftermath of the Publication of the General Theory. It fits in, sort of, with Mark's excellent exposition of what the General Theory is really about. But he asked me to say some things about Joan on time and equilibrium and so on. I think that'll come out more in discussion because at this time she hadn't formulated completely her views on this. This was to come later after she'd read Marx and thought some more about things. So, in the Michaelmas term of 1930, Piero Straffer formed the Circus in order to discuss a treatise on money, Keynes's 1930, meant to be magnum opus. And the Circus consisted of Austin and Joan Robinson, Richard Kahn, James Mead, who was in Cambridge for a year before teaching economics at Oxford. Now, that was a case of technical regress because Harrod only came for a term in the early 20s before he was allowed to teach economics at Oxford. But by the time Mead came, he had to spend a whole year here. Now, if we discount for the differences in the brain power of Harrod and Mead, I don't know whether it's a regress or technical advance, or perhaps economics had just got more complicated. But anyway, he spent a year here and was in this very close group. And Straffer himself. It ran until March 1931, so it started in October and ran until March 31. But in the summer term of 31, there was a seminar with other members of the faculty and the best of the third-year students. So in a sense, May 1931 marks the end of the period of the Circus. This is Kahn's reminiscences of this in a book I edited in 85 and published in 85, and in volume 13 of the collected writings of Keynes. Keynes did not attend in person, and Margaret Mead, James's wife, described him as akin to God off stage in a morality play with Kahn the go-between, the messenger angel from God, taking messages, from mortals' discussions and criticisms to heaven and returning with God's responses. So, some members of the Circus also attended Keynes's lectures in the 1930s as he started to make what became the General Theory. Partly as a response to the criticism and queries of the Circus and after, but also and principally in response to both criticisms by the profession generally and most crucially in response to the changed circumstances of the capitalist world as the Great Depression emerged. Now, I wonder if someone is writing a new General Theory at the moment as similar sorts of circumstances are occurring around us as we go, or if they've got any sense, they'll go back and start with Keynes and kick on from there, don't you reckon? Not only did Keynes begin to rethink on theory, he also changed his emphasis on policy, becoming more and more sceptical about concerning the ability of monetary policy alone to tackle the malfunctioning of the economies of the UK and the USA in particular. In a treatise on money and beforehand, monetary policy had been directed principally at maintaining a stable general price level. The circus itself concentrated especially on Keynes's assumption that there could be a change in the voluntary desire to save without there being any effect on the output, as opposed to the prices of consumption goods, and so on employment in those trades and indeed overall. Keynes was subsequently to say that they, he wrote to Joan Robinson, even though it was Austin Robinson who initially latched onto the widow's cruise fallacy, as the above argument was dubbed, were a little hard on him, because it was only a provisional assumption which an author was entitled to make in proceeding, allowing the dominant forces at work in a given situation to be seen and understood more starkly and clearly before the complications were introduced in a fuller, more comprehensive and realistic analysis. To quote Keynes, only at one particular point had he assumed constant output. He made this absolutely clear. One must be allowed at a particular stage of an argument to make simplifying assumptions. Hayek was Keynes's foremost critic when A Treatise on Money was published, with his review articles in Economica and exchanges with Keynes. Keynes's reply to Hayek drifted into his own review of Hayek's Prices and Production, which had been published in 1931, and may be coupled with Schraffer's review article of Prices and Production in the Economic Journal, published in 1932, and Schraffer's subsequent exchange with Hayek over it, also in the EJ in 1932. Keynes, as editor of the EJ, had of course asked Schraffer to write the review article, which has surely been the role model for effective hatchet reviews ever since. And we have in the audience today Kostas Rapapas, who started his excellent PhD thesis with an examination of Hayek and Schraffer's exchanges and then the exchanges with Keynes and Joan Robinson. So if any of you want to get it from the horse's mouth about that, he's sitting modestly at the back, as befits a senior scholar, or perhaps he wants to go to sleep, and perhaps you could ask him if you're interested. Now, Joan Robinson wrote an article about the Hayek-Keynes exchanges in 1931. However, it was not published in Economica until 1933. The article was called A Parable of Savings and Investment. The author assumed familiarity with the terminology, definitions and approach of A Treatise on Money, including knowledge of the paragraphs on the widow's cruise and the Dynard jars. As Robert Skidelsky in Volume 2 of his wonderful biography of Keynes put it, God ensured that the widow's jar was always full of water, however much the prophet Elijah drank from it. A widow's cruise, off we go. Elijah did not spill it down his front, like others I could name. By contrast, the Danaides, I hope I've got this right, of Greek legend. Have I got it right, Kostas?
No. It's recorded, so please refrain from further references.
Right. By contrast, what I said of Greek legend had to carry the water to the city of Argos in broken jars. He adds, these stories suggested to Keynes a striking analogy with the cumulative processes which might be set in train by the emergence of windfall losses and profits and losses. Joan's article was addressed to the simple-minded reader within which class she included herself. She set herself to explain why in Keynes's view, and as theoretical propositions only, there could be a depression while maintaining full employment and a trade boom without an increase in output. This was still very much an argument within the framework of A Treatise on Money by someone brought up in the quantity theory approach. That is to say, Keynes's Marshallian training meant that in both his great books he used Marshall's three-period approach, the market period with a given supply, the short period with short period flows constrained by stocks of capital goods and skilled labour forces, and a long period in which both capital and labour were variable, but changes in technical methods, once the analysis had begun, were confined to the caterus paribus pound, all suitably adapted to a macroeconomic setting. Keynes tells us explicitly in a preface to A Treatise on Money the principal analysis he has in mind. Market clearing prices for the existing stock of commodities are set in the market period. They induce changes in output and so in prices in the short period, and the consequential short period equilibria converge over time, in quotes, on the long period position, the full stock flow equilibrium in which normal profits and wages are received. All this is the background to Joan Robinson's discussion. But her article also contains ideas of great importance for understanding later developments in the thoughts and contributions of Keynes and his followers. In particular, there is concern with the process of price formation in, first, markets where flows dominate stocks, and secondly, in markets where stocks dominate flows, and thirdly, the vital importance of having a class of speculative traders who take views on the future course of market prices while not being producers of the commodities concerned themselves. These ideas came to their fulfilment in Nicholas Cowdor's greatest theoretical paper, Speculation and Economic Stability, published in 1939 in the Review of Economic Studies. Yes. And it was an extraordinarily, extraordinary paper. And Nicky thought it was his best, and so did all the insightful Cowdor watchers, including John Hicks, who was his great friend in the 30s. In the context of the exchanges between Hayek and Keynes, it is the consumption goods trades which are characterised by the first sort of market, the capital goods trades by the second, and the market for securities by the third factor. So, consumption goods flows dominate stocks, capital goods stocks dominate flows, and in the securities market you have a group of specialist traders who make the market, in effect. The discussions by both Keynes and Joan Robinson of the second sort of market are somewhat masked by the fact that the stock of existing securities, which are backed by the stock of physical capital goods created by past investment, dominates the determination of the prices of securities and capital goods newly created and old. In post-general theory times, this seems a confusion. In the general theory, Keynes assumes explicitly that free competition is usually the characteristic of the markets for all types of commodities. Thus, marginal costs of production dominate the determination of the prices of new capital goods, given the demand for the services of all capital goods, and the supply of existing capital goods in a given short period situation, as Paul Davidson brilliantly makes clear in Money in the Real World, his 1972 book. As for the market for securities, Joan Robinson points out that if there was not a divergence of views concerning the course of their prices in the future, so that at any moment of time every market participator or potential participator was either a bull or a bear, the prices of securities would fluctuate between infinity and zero, respectively. And something akin to that you may have noticed happening at Days on the stock exchange in recent days. With divergent views, the equilibrium prices which are established bring about at least momentary truces between the bulls and bears in the special class of speculators traders identified above. The infant theory of liquidity preference of the general theory may be discerned here. In her other 1933 article, prophetically entitled The Theory of Money and the Analysis of Output, which has often been reprinted, Joan Robinson, like Keynes, still seems to be suspended between two worlds. In the introduction to her first collection of economic papers in 1951, she writes that her first article, written for the first number of the Review of Economic Studies, a journal founded by some of the younger members of the LSE and of the Cambridge faculty to get together behind the backs of their embattled seniors, and known by Dennis Robertson as the Green Horror, because it had a bright green cover and it was full of squiggles, which he didn't like. So it gives an outline of Keynes's theory. I'm sorry, this article, the second article, gave an outline of Keynes's theories as far as it had got in 1933. She added that she wrote the Economica article in the summer of 31, attempting to explain Keynes's answer to the buckets in the well theory, that when thriftiness increases, the demand for capital goods rises by an equal amount. She thought the article to be somewhat tedious now, and she never reprinted it, wrongly in Prue and my view. She says she never knew why it was published until 1933, a few months before the R.E. Studs article came out, leading Paul Samuelson and Lawrence Klein to date the birth of the general theory between February and October 1933, when the two articles were actually published. She told this tale as an awful warning to historians. So take that on board if there are any scholars in the room, which I'm sure there are. So I said that she seems to be suspended like Keynes between two worlds, for she tells us that Keynes, without batting an eyelid, has provided us with a long period theory of overall output and employment in a setting initially established to analyse the determination of the general price level in a theory of money. Keynes, she said, had failed to notice when he wrote a treatise on money that he had incidentally evolved a new theory of the long period analysis of output. Moreover, she says, he completely overlooks its significance and does not pause to remark that he has proved that output may be in equilibrium at any number of different levels, and while there is a natural tendency towards equilibrium between savings and investment in a very long run, there is no natural tendency towards full employment of the factors of production. Joan Robinson also points out how Keynes, as with other quantity theorists, was often bamboozled by what the manipulation of identities could and could not do. She argues that it is idle to say that abnormal profits cause new investment, as they are but a symptom of a situation in which new investment will take place. Also, to regard them as a direct cause of a rise in output is misleading, and moreover, as there are no abnormal profits in long-period equilibrium, especially on a treatise of money definitions, a theory which regards actual profits as the mainspring of action is incapable of dealing with long-period analysis. She noted, too, that Keynes was inhibited by feeling that writing a treatise on money required him to concentrate on issues concerned with the general level of prices and neglect output and its changes in disequilibrium and equilibrium. Keynes was well aware of this, of course. Here are typical statements in Keynes's letters to Ralph Hawtrey of November the 28th, 1930, after the publication of a treatise on money, but in reply to Hawtrey's comment on the proofs. He says, this is Keynes, "The question how much reduction in output is caused is important, but it's not strictly a monetary problem. Keynes had not attempted to deal with it. He was primarily concerned with what governs prices." Again, in another place, he says, "I am not dealing with the complete set of causes which determine the volume of output. This would have led him an endlessly long journey into the theory of short-period supply and a long way from monetary theory. Agree that it will probably be difficult in the future, to prevent monetary theory and the theory of short-period supply from running together." And that was in 1930 he was writing that. It's in volume 13 of the Collected Writings. Joan Robinson partially confirms this in the conclusion of her article. She says, "The theory of money, relieved of its too heavy task, can be confined to its proper sphere and become indeed a theory of money, while the analysis of output can continue to develop an analysis of output." We write partially because she was still accepting the classical dichotomy between the real and the money, which Keynes was to overthrow in the general theory. Now, are all of you familiar with who these people I'm talking about? Richard Kahn, Pierre Osraffer, James Mead, Joan and Austin Robinson, are they all familiar names to you? Oh dear, the walls will shake. Well, well, they were all they were all Keynes' younger colleagues and former pupils who formed a close-knit group around him when he was writing the general theory and really teaching in the faculty. They were very, very young when they were in the circus. I think the oldest person then was Piero Sraffa, actually. Piero Sraffa was a famous Italian economist who was chased out of Italy by Mussolini and brought to Cambridge to a lectureship by Keynes, persuading the faculty to employ him. He was the intimate friend of Gramsci, Wittgenstein and Keynes, and I would say he was one of the major intellectual influences on fundamental thought in the 20th century. When I got to know him, he was in charge of the research students here, and he was the librarian of the Marshall Library, and this was in 1955. He had just completed his great editions of Ricardo's works and correspondence in collaboration with M.H. Dobb, Morris Dobb, and it was 5 years before his magnum opus, Production of Commodities by Means of Commodities, which is the single most important critique of the conceptual foundations of neoclassical economics that's ever been published, in my view, but also serves the purpose of rehabilitating classical and Marxian economics as the proper way to think about capitalism. Austin Robinson and Joan were husband and wife, but Joan had been Austin's pupil. Austin was about 5 years older than Joan. They'd married in 26 and gone to India for 2 years, which started both of their love affairs with development economics and the subcontinent. Austin was the pioneer of industrial organisation, in effect, in Cambridge, and was a great all-round economist with a wonderful mind. He was an applied political economist par excellence. His biographer, Alec Cairncross, said. Joan, of course, wrote her first great book was The Economics of Imperfect Competition, which she subsequently was to repudiate. Then she wrote a whole... she was a very, very prolific writer, as you'll find out if you read this biography that Prue and I have written. I think she published well over 400 papers and must have published, I suppose, about, if you count her collected papers, probably about 18 books as well. A quite remarkable woman. James Mead was to go on to be to get the Nobel Prize, the only one of that group actually to get the Nobel Prize. Sraffa got the equivalent of the Nobel Prize before it was established, some gong that the Swedes passed out. There's a photo of him in tired tails shaking the hands of the King of Sweden, which is an old communist, communist sympathiser like Pirro made me giggle. But then there's Lord Eatwell. Mead subsequently got the Nobel Prize. He worshipped Keynes. Keynes was the great influence on his life. And he was the professor of political economy here from 1957 to 1960, when he took early retirement, in order to write what Marshall never got round to writing, A Complete Principles of Economics. The stationary economy, the growing economy, the just economy, and on it went. Quite unreadable books, but very clear. But a lovely man, James. His one limitation was that he thought the world was made up of civilised and liberal progressive people like James Mead. So a lot of his policy proposals were completely impractical because they weren't made up of people like James, unfortunately. And his widow, Margaret, only died last year, just 2 months short of her 100th birthday. which is really rather sad. Anyway, that's filled you in a bit. I also want to tell you that Prue Kerr was my undergraduate master's and PhD student, undergraduate and master's student in Adelaide and PhD student here. And we have collaborated for many years, and between us, we reckon, we've written well over 100 essays and volumes on Joan Robinson and her circle, which we're trying to bring all together in this book. So, and Richard Kahn, of course, was Keynes's favourite pupil and his greatest critic, and whom Keynes loved. He said, "I have just spent the morning having a stiff supervision from Richard Kahn. There is no one in all the world who is better to show your stuff to." And Kahn himself said he was a disciple of Keynes, and that was his raison d'etre as an intellectual. Okay, and all these people were very, very close friends in Cambridge. Now, Kahn was in the US for the early part of the 1930s. Before he went, he had published his famous article on the multiplier, published in the EJ in 31, in which, under carefully specified conditions, he'd put an exact figure on the overall rise in employment which could be captured from a given increase in primary employment. And this removed the fuzziness surrounding Keynes and Hubert Henderson's arguments concerning the impact of public works in their 1929 pamphlet, "Can Lloyd George Do It?" Well, history has shown us that Lloyd George could do it all right, but that was hidden at the time. It was also noted for James Mead's contribution, which an in-joke called it Mr. Mead's Relation, which didn't mean his aunt, but it meant doing the multiplier by leakages into saving rather than on the marginal propensity to consume. And Mead wrote a retrospective article on that in the EJ in 1933, explaining how he and Kahn got together and how he did the saving version of the multiplier. Kahn's article played a key role in Keynes's subsequent specification of the consumption function and his own chapters on the multiplier in the general theory, as Mark has been telling us. Kahn was much missed by Keynes as Keynes started on his journey to the general theory, and by Joan Robinson as she was writing The Economics of Imperfect Competition. He did correspond frequently with them, especially with Joan. Kahn, in turn, was worried about being the sole or at least the principal recipient and critic of Keynes's writings. He urged Joan to come on board as well. In a letter of the 2nd of March, March 1933, wrote, "Naturally you cannot raise the point, but if Maynard hints that he would like you to look at his stuff, I wish you would. I'm a bit appalled at the prospect of having the sole responsibility thrust on me after my return." She was more than willing to do so, and she did, so enthusiastically that by September 34 she wrote to Kahn to ask whether Keynes would, and I quote, "like her to write him a preface for the new work showing in what respect his ideas have altered." This is not the only time when she misjudged what another author's feelings could be, especially those of Keynes. Though he ultimately was to welcome what she called her told-to-the-children version of the general theory, her Introduction to the Theory of Employment, published in 1937, by writing to her in November 37, "you have been very successful in simplifying and have skated round the complications beautifully." Initially, he was lukewarm about the project, to say the least. Piero Sraffa, too, was sometimes irritated by her interpretations and applications of his writings, though it did not harm their deep, caring and supportive friendship with one another, which I've documented in some of my articles on the relationship between Joan and Piero. Joan had three very bad breakdowns during her life, the second one just before the Second World War, and there's some beautiful letters from Piero to her while she was in Fulbourne recovering, showing how deeply he cared for her and how much he understood her and how he's trying to cheer her up with gossip and strange stories and so on, which Piero was very adept at doing, I can tell you. One of the funniest men I ever met, once you got to know him. Moreover, Keynes came increasingly to appreciate her comments and responses and not least her fierce loyalty to the new ideas against the antagonistic doubting Thomases amongst Keynes's previous supporters and even collaborators and friends, Dennis Robertson, of course, Hawtrey, Pigou and Hubert Henderson, for example. As volume 13 of the collected writings shows, Joan became an integral part of the criticisms and support of the emerging general theory. In particular, Joan and Kahn supported Keynes's use of a Marshallian approach in the general theory, despite Schraffer's trenchant critique of it at the level of the Furman industry in the 1920s and 1930s. And it was Christina Macusa, historian of thought at Rome, who we're indebted to for this point. She knew Richard Kahn and Joan very well, and of course knew Schraffer quite well as well. Simultaneously, Joan, Kahn, Mead and Austin Robinson were debating with the younger stalwarts of Hayek and Robbins at the LSE, especially Abba Lerner. Have you all heard of Abba Lerner? Oh, he's a great... he was a Russian emigre and a graduate of the LSE who ended up in America, but he was a very, very brilliant international trade and macroeconomics and microeconomics theorist. His best-known book is The Economics of Control, yeah, which was his PhD thesis, all about socialism. And guess who his supervisor was? Hayek. So Hayek was a true liberal in his approach to research students. When Shackle came to work with him, and he was going to work on Hayek, and he was starting to work on it, and then the general theory came out, and Shackle got all excited, and he said, went to see Hayek and said he'd really like to work on aspects of Keynes's work. "Be my guest, my boy," he said. He was in that sense, he was a genuine liberal. And in other regards, he was a rather authoritarian and unpleasant man. But there we are. We can't all be perfect. Lerner was to become, for a while at least, one of Keynes's most fervent disciples, and this despite efforts by the doubters to keep him on the straight and narrow, when, following one of the meetings of the young, he showed signs of wobbling. At an inn halfway between London and Cambridge, possibly at Audley End, but I've never been able to pinpoint it completely, Mead and Kahn explained the multiplier to the LSE band, the young LSE people who came up. Quoting Joan, "Next day, with some help, Lerner repeated it correctly and seemed to be convinced. His companions were quite shocked and were seen afterwards walking up and down the lawn trying to restore his faith." Laurie Tarshis, who was a affiliated student and then a PhD student in Cambridge at the time, also played a key role in Lerner's conversion with their post-Marmite sandwich luncheon discussions of the respective merits of their two heroes. As with virtually all North Americans, we believe, Tarshis never did take to Marmite or Vegemite, and so had to leave his rooms in Trinity until Lerner had eaten his Marmite sandwiches in them. Now, how many of you know what Marmite is? You don't?
Yes.
You do?
Yes.
How many of you know what Vegemite is? Hooray, that's the Australian equivalent of Marmite and far superior to it. Anyway, no North American I've ever known can stand the smell of either Marmite or Vegemite, so when Abba Lerner came up with his Marmite sandwiches for lunch to Laurie's rooms in Trinity, Laurie would go outside until he finished. And do you know who Laurie shared his rooms with? John Cairncross, the fifth man, though he didn't know he was the fifth man at the time. You know, there was all these Trinity spies. And John Cairncross, the younger brother, I think, of Alec, well, I don't know whether he's younger or older brother of Alec, shared a room with Laurie when he was an affiliated student. Anyway, there's a bit of gossip for you. I must tell you that a dopey English journalist wrote a stupid book arguing that Harold Holt, the Australian Prime Minister who drowned at Portsea, was a Chinese spy and had been taken off by a Chinese submarine, taken back to China, rather than drowning. So when this
never found,
he's never found. So when this happened, I went into my lectures and I said, At last I can hold my head up. An old boy of my school and my university college, who was became the Prime Minister of Australia, has been revealed as a Chinese spy. Eat your heart out, you Trinity poo-bars. And nobody knew what the heck I was talking about. Some of the more industrious students wrote it down in case it came up in the exams. But anyway. As with Kahn and Keynes, by the time the general theory was published, Joan Robinson too emphasised that the short period in its own right was the setting both for Kahn's work on prices and Keynes on employment. Kahn had written a remarkable dissertation called The Economics of the Short Period for his dissertation at King's, his fellowship dissertation. This is witnessed too first by Keynes's list of what is locked up in the caterus paribus pound on page 245 of the general theory, and by Joan Robinson's own excursion into long-period analysis in her essays on the theory of employment, published in 1937. Now, she did this mainly in order to see whether the results of the general theory were robust, even though she regarded the exercise by then as very much economics for the economists and certainly not the province of the general theory itself. You can see this in a letter to Keynes in 35 about her long-period analysis. She says, commenting on what became 219 of the general theory, page 219, she wrote, "In what sense is there long period equilibrium if investment is still going on? You have stopped," she meant stepped, "rather suddenly out of the short period with fixed equipment to which the rest of the book belongs." And after further comment, she concludes, "I've been working out this long period stuff. One needs to bring in several considerations that are not really relevant to your main theme. The elasticity of substitution is an important factor. This section is in a limbo between long and short periods. You could make your point without bringing the long period in. If you do, a definition of equilibrium is essential." Here we have it. The theme of Marx's talks. Nevertheless, in her exposition of the new theory in her introduction, she remains distinctly old-fashioned when considering long-period propositions, quoting, "For the discussion of problems involving broad changes over the course of generations in population, the rate of technical progress, or the general social forces influencing thriftiness, it's possible to regard fluctuations in employment as secondary considerations and to conduct the discussions in terms of a self-regulating system." Straight out of Mankiw. As far as the... straight out of Joan, actually, but it could have come out of Mankiw. As far as the development of the general theory is concerned, it is, as we've noted above, her essay on the long period that's most relevant. She uses the concept of the elasticity of substitution between capital and labour, then at the height of fashion, and for Frank Hahn's 80th birthday, Bob Solow read a paper read a paper on the elasticity of substitutions, 73 years old, and what was its value. It was a very nice paper, actually, if you like that sort of thing. And differential saving behaviour at the margin for wage earners and profit receivers to tease out many of the general theory propositions established for the short period. Her long period is a very Marshallian concept, what Dennis Robinson in 1956 dubbed the never-never land of unrealised tendency of pure theory, for net investment is zero at the optimum stock of capital goods in the given as the optimum stock of capital goods in the given situation has been established and only normal profits are received. Hawtrey in his review of her essays, but not Harrod in his review, was sceptical about the value of such an elaborate analysis. It is true that it is a hybrid of the old and the new, but it does make the positive contribution of showing that effective demand makes theoretical sense in a long period setting and that a full employment equilibrium is not necessarily a long period outcome. And this was confirmed yet again and many years later by Colin Rogers in his contribution to a second edition of the General Theory in 1997. In the 1983 special issue of the Cambridge Journal of Economics in honour of Joan, there were a number of articles about her 1937 long period theory. Jan Kregel represents her as producing a long-period theory of effective demand based on the orthodox theory of distribution, which captures both the effect of saving on the capital stock and the importance of relative factor prices in acting as part of a self-adjusting mechanism to create equilibrium. John Eatwell, and later Pierangelo Garignani, also interpret her argument as neoclassical and flawed. Eatwell establishes the non-Keynesian nature of her essay by showing that in order to reach unorthodox results, she has to operate where the elasticity of substitution was less than unity. Terry O'Shaughnessy develops her neoclassical reasoning to achieve non-neoclassical results, disputing the flaw which Eatwell and Garignani claim to exist in her explanation. She also developed the concept of disguised unemployment, so ultimately bringing her observations while in India in the late 1920s with her understanding of, bringing together her observations while in India with her understanding of and contributions to the new theory emerging in Cambridge. Her 1937 essays also contain her exposition of what was later become known in the literature as the Harris-Tadaro model of internal migration. Purvis Tahir has documented this in telling detail, illustrating yet again how dangerous it is to be too far ahead of your time. He refers to her as a neglected precursor. And I have a certain sympathy about this because I wrote my PhD thesis on accounting in historical costs and replacement cost accounting in inflationary times. And then by the time I put in, inflation had virtually gone away. And then about 20 years later, I was called as an expert witness to in Australia on this by a chap called Russell Matthews, who had been a great influence on me when I wrote my PhD, actually. And I said to him, you know, Russell, the trouble with you and me is that we're so far ahead of our time, but by the time our time comes, we've forgotten what we said. Keynes and Joan had extensive debates over her chapter on the foreign exchanges, and he probably still had some reservations about its final form when the volume was published. In commenting on the proofs, he considered the book as a whole a bit uneven, but the general effect splendid, full of originality and interest. She had reservations about his definition of full employment and wrote a very long first chapter about the concept itself. This is in her essays in the Theory of Employment. Now, to our mind, that's Prue and me, Keynes's discussion and definitions of full employment and involuntary unemployment were exactly what was needed for the purposes he had in mind when writing a book, and I quote, chiefly addressed to his fellow economists, the main purpose of which was to deal with the difficult questions of theory and only secondarily with the applications of theory to practice. As is well known, Keynes has defined involuntary unemployment on page 15 of the General Theory as follows. You've done it, I suppose, haven't you?
Yeah.
Yep. But I'll repeat it again just for those who perhaps haven't been here. Men, sick, sorry ladies, that's Keynes, are involuntarily unemployed if, in the event of a small rise in the price of wage goods relatively to the money wage, both the aggregate supply of labour willing to work for the current money wage and the aggregate demand for it at that wage would be greater than the existing volume of employment. He argued on page 26 that in the classical system, which we know now that he meant Pigou's version, as Ambrosi's book, Ambrosi's talk to this seminar shows very convincingly, effective demand is an infinite range of values, all equally admissible, so that the marginal disutility of labour sets an upper limit when further increases in the value of effective demand will no longer be associated with greater output. This gives rise to a definition of full employment equivalent to the one on page 15. Aggregate employment is inelastic in response to an increase in effective demand for its output. We know that Keynes was willing to accept, for his theoretical purposes, the first classical postulate of the equality of the real wage with the marginal product of labour, assuming freely competitive market structures, but not the second postulate regarding labour supply and the real wage. A simple diagram, which I've handed out, has everyone got a copy of it? Illustrates what he had in mind and his equivalent definitions of full employment in the sense of the absence of involuntary unemployment. So on the vertical axis, I've measured, or we've measured, the marginal, this is not the royal we, this is Prue and me, we measure the marginal product of labour and the real wage, and we assume that the relative prices of wage and non-wage goods do not change when production of them does. On the horizontal axis, we measure employment, M. We show on the D curve possible points of effective demand. On the S curve, voluntary supplies of labour services associated with each level of the real wage and its associated money wage and price level of wage goods. The intersection of the two curves at E corresponds to both of Keynes's definition of full employment. Now consider point A on the D curve. Then MPL1A is the amount of labour demanded, and it is less than the supply, RW subscript 1B. Suppose now that the prices of wage goods are greater relative to the money wage, so that C is the new point of effective demand. CD equals N2N3 is the amount of involuntary unemployment. We see that both the aggregate supply of labour at the current money wage, ON3, and the aggregate demand for labour, ON2, exceed the existing volume of employment, ON1. So I think that diagram, if you like diagrams, which I do, makes sense of what Keynes was doing, and I don't see what the fuss was about. Now, Jones' analysis was much more detailed and practical, discussing possible trade union employer and government behaviour. She concentrated on the likely effects on money wages in given situations, and she identified three possible ranges of employment: those so low that money wages would tend to fall, an intermediate range where they would tend to remain constant, and a range of higher levels where they would tend to increase. She thought that the intermediate range would have levels of employment well below the level of full employment, both on Keynes's definition and on her own more loosely defined one. Similarly, she defines involuntary unemployment as the amount of work which, in existing conditions, the population is willing but unable to perform. She adds, "No absolutely precise measure of this quantity can be found, but for all practical purposes, a common sense definition will suffice. Moreover, in this sense, unemployment may exist even when money wages are rising." So we've taken a more favourable view of Keynes's definition analysis than either David Champernowne or Joan Robinson did at the time. And if you want a full discussion of their reasons, there's a very nice paper by Mauro Boyanowski published in the Cambridge Journal of Economics in 2005 going into their arguments. Harrow wrote an extremely favourable review of her essays, a volume of great distinction. While never departing from a high level of precise thinking, she has occasion to apply her finely wrought analytical tools to the problems of the hour, an interplay of her fine mind with the slipshod constructions of popular thought makes a delightful entertainment. So I've always said, in Oxford, it's all style, but very little substance. Roberto is going to kill me. It is also notable for Harrod signalling issues that were to dominate discussions in later years. What is meant by a quantity of capital and its marginal product in long period conditions? Keynes had alerted Joan to the incoherent nature of capital and its marginal product in macroeconomic analysis, especially when using the concept of the elasticity of substitution of capital for labour in situations when technical progress was occurring. She dodged by saying that Schraffer, and I quote, was devoting his life to the question of the meaning and measurement of capital, and we cannot expect an answer quickly. Schraffer's great work, Production of Commodities by Means of Commodities, is less than 100 pages long, so he has an average product of half a page a year. Two pages a year, the amount of time it took from go to woe. Not how to write your PhD thesis, though a number of Schraffer's students have tried to do so, or have behaved like that since, especially Pierangelo Garignani, whose concept of time is that it's infinite as far as he's concerned, because he's sure that in the end he'll catch up. Harrod also signalled his subsequent debates with Joan concerning the nature of technical progress. In particular, what were the definitions of labour-saving and capital-saving inventions, and what should be held constant when the definitions are set out? He suggested the rate of interest. Finally, while admiring how much he was able to get out of the static method, he nevertheless called for a move to dynamic methods, a foretaste of what he was to present explicitly in his 1939 An Essay on Dynamic Theory. Be that as it may, what was to radically change her focus and emphasis in the later years of the 1930s was the beginning of her intellectual friendship with Michał Kalecki in 1936, and her introduction to Marxian thought, initially through her review in the EJ of John Strachey's 1935 The Nature of Capitalist Crisis. The first part of the review is reproduced in her 1930 essays, and then in the early years of the war, her first systematic readings of Marx's writings, which we discuss in the next chapter in the book. Christina Macusa and Claudio Sedoni print an amusing anecdote about the review of Strachey's book. It's to be found in an unpublished paper of Jones. I accused Strachey of presenting the labour theory of value in terms of Say's law, ignoring Keynes, and treating Hayek as representative of academic economics. He replied that it was absurd for someone who had never read Marx to talk about him. We each felt that the other made a fair point. He began to read Keynes, and I read Marx. So, that's chapter 3 of the book, there are 12 chapters in all. So we have an introduction, the making of the economics of imperfect competition, Joan and her circle and the general theory, Joan on Marx, Joan on socialist planning in the years of high theory, then the making of the accumulation of capital, her magnum opus, the choice of technique in the economy as a whole and the capital theory debates, after the accumulation of capital, her defence and development of it, then Joan on development, including all her writings on China, then the Robinson and Eatwell textbook that they wrote when Joan retired to try and offset the subversion of young minds by the mainstream neoclassical economists, Joan's three popular books, An Awkward Corner, Economic Philosophy, and Freedom and Necessity, and then a concluding chapter called The Legacy of Joan Robinson. So that's it. So that is a tantalising preview of the coming attraction. Thank you very much.
What is the legacy?
Oh, you read the concluding chapter. It's a very long chapter. But if you want to know what I think it is, my first essay on Joan Robinson was written in the early 1970s when Angus Wilson, who was the orator at the University of East Anglia, wrote to me at Harold Lydall's suggestion because they were going to give Joan an honorary degree. So I sat down and wrote a little essay called Portrait of a Lady, a very original title, as you understand. I just adored Henry James. Do you know that when you went to dinner with Henry James, he talked as he wrote. So you would be having your soup spoon like this while Henry went into subclause after subclause. And so your soup got very, very cold before it was polite manners to put it in your mouth. Then that was the basis of the entry I wrote on Joan Robinson in the Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences, the Biographical Supplement, Volume 18. And then when she died, an American economist was commissioned to write her obituary for the EJ. But after 10 years, he didn't do it. And by that time, I was the obituary editor. So I gave him three ultimata and had no effect. So I withdrew the commission and wrote it myself. And then after Pruitt, I had written the book, and we were thinking about summing up. The concluding chapter consists really of putting together what I said in the 1970s and what I said in the obituary of the EJ.
You still stood?
Yes, I was very pleased to see that the first essay I wrote on it, that was written in all the enthusiasm and bravado of the 70s when I was a radical dissenting, leading the anti-war movement and all the student revolts and that. I was not a student, by the way, I was a professor. but in some ways, I've never grown out of being an undergraduate. I was glad to see that a lot of the judgments we made there stood up to our, particularly Prue's, very careful going over what Joan had done in the meantime. So if you have an email, Joan, I will send you chapter 12 and you can see what her legacy is. But otherwise you can look up those two papers.
Well, I give you the email.
Yeah, you give me your email. Right. Good. Okay.